Okay, I guess we've started.
I think the day after we recorded that, I saw this article. And I'm gonna read from, well, it was Italy seizes 500 fake Francis Bacon works. Right. So fake bacon.
Bacon.
Last week we were talking about forgeries, and I was asking, well, who authenticates the authenticator? So here's a line from the story. Five people have been charged with criminal conspiracy to authenticate and circulate fake works of art and fraud and money laundering, according to an official statement. The very thing I was complaining about is, like, you know, I was postulating you could literally set up a ring of authenticators who could just send these things around and around and around. And in fact, that's exactly what's happening.
Wow.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like the world is somehow plugged into my brain, because I'll say something on the podcast and then I literally said something about Neil deGrasse Tyson, and then Stephen Colbert said the exact same thing the next day.
Right. And then he also talked about that.
I'm sorry. I meant to say Stephen Colbert.
Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, because this is America, goddammit.
And he also referenced the invisible sculpture guy that you didn't think was worthy of our puny podcast.
Right, the Floridian.
Yes.
Good call.
Yeah, the whole thing. Colbert. And you're like, did he listen to our show? And I'm like, yeah, probably.
So you want some fake bacon? Fakin' bacon?
I eat fake bacon.
Francis Bacon is pretty amazing to me. I don't know how he painted. I really don't understand his process. I mean, I guess you can break anything down, but
right. It
looks like a nightmare to me.
Uh-huh.
Literally on canvas, but I don't know how you would be able to manipulate the imagery like that. It astonishes me.
I think we need a podcast just deconstructing bacon.
I would never want a bacon in my house, but I think he was a genius.
Right. Yeah, I don't eat bacon.
I mean, mostly because he was a white male.
Oh, okay.
Well, you wouldn't eat the artwork.
Right.
Okay, don't.
Well, we were talking about fake bacon, and I was just thinking.
Could you please stop eating the artwork?
I'm hungry, but I only eat, like, turkey bacon because I don't eat pork, so.
Okay.
Yeah, only because it's my Chinese zodiac symbol.
Do you know Rick Steves?
No.
You don't know Rick Steves?
No.
Oh, come on.
I don't.
This guy blows my mind. He is like a mild manner, boring Midwesterner, like absolutely stereotypical, dull, boring Midwesterner that does these extraordinary travel videos.
Wait, maybe I know him by sight. I don't often know people by name.
Oh, he's the blandest person you can imagine. Are you Googling him right now on your phone?
Yes, I know this guy.
Put your damn phone down. You know how annoying that is? Oh, my God.
I know this guy. I do. Rick Steves. Okay, got it.
Okay.
But, you know, I would know him if I saw him on Channel 8 on Saturday morning and he was doing his travel logs, but name meant nothing. Go ahead.
Put the phone down and talk to me as a human being, okay? Not as some kind of cyborg.
Rick Steves.
You didn't have to do it. I was telling you who it was.
Okay, go.
I am your Google.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, I had the visual.
Well, you know who it is now.
Yeah.
It's like, why am I even here? Why don't you just have the podcast with Google? You and your phone can talk back and forth, and Siri can be on there.
My hand cramps. I have my phone in my hand so much.
Well, maybe you could have someone else, an assistant, hold it for you, or you can put it on a stand.
Go, talk about Rick Steves. What are we talking about?
Oh, I don't know why I was talking about him.
Because he's the most boring human on the planet?
No, he's boring is a very hard word.
Okay,
he's very plain,
sorry, Rick.
But he makes amazing videos.
Yes.
His travel logs, I just find super engaging. And they're on YouTube now, all of them.
Oh,
without
really?
Ads. So you can just go and binge watch Rick Steves.
I will.
Why did I bring up him?
I don't know.
We were talking about bacon.
I know.
Wow.
That was a stretch.
I'm sure I had some reason to bring him up, but that reason is now gone.
Because I picked up my phone.
Yes, exactly. You see what happens?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, what are we doing today?
We were going to talk about Luis Nevelson.
Right, because I was going to ask you. I took the garbage out yesterday morning.
Wow.
And I thought...
That's a way to lead into Nevelson, huh?
Yeah, that's a...
I took the garbage out.
No, I didn't mean that. But, and I thought, you know, I've made stuff from garbage, you know, and I've been kind of into this recycling thing as our planet. I think what really spurred me, and we had talked about discussing Nevelson, but the other day on the news, they had this thing about, I think it was Ghana, with all of the clothing that's recycled or not recycled. Mm-hmm. It just ends up in landfills.
Right. So yeah, in a lot of Africa, I remember reading a story about this a few years ago. Used clothing from the U.S. is shipped up and packed off and resold in Africa, because apparently the United States just consumes massive quantities of clothing every year.
Clothing,
you know,
right.
Fast fashion and whatnot.
Yeah, the fast fashion.
I literally have boxer shorts from when I was in high school, so that was 30 years ago. No,
yeah.
It was more than 30 years ago. 32 years ago.
Yeah, I tend to wear my clothes out. I don't, I used to shop a lot more when I was younger. The older you get, the less it seems relevant. But the fast fashion industry.
Well, not for Nevelson.
No, not for Nevelson. But I, you know, that really spurred me. And they're like, it's an environmental crisis. And they show these fumes coming up from these piles of clothing. You can see the, you know, labels. I won't cite any of the labels. They were showing the labels of the clothing.
That's all right. Cite the labels.
And
shame them.
No, it's okay. But basically, it was all of them, so it doesn't really matter, you know. And it just was such a, and I thought, oh, my gosh. And, you know, I have a friend who, her primary expression, I guess, and she's a crafter and somewhat of an artist, and but all of her work is done with recycled clothing, every single bit of it.
Oh, you mean and, like quilt?
Yeah, she makes, well, she does make like small art quilts, but she primarily makes like wearable stuff, a lot of handbags and some stuff for the kitchen. And it's just really delightful and it's very whimsical.
I mean, it's a little bit ironic, though. We talk about found art and is being a new thing for people to explore with Nevelson. And it's like, well, isn't that just quilting?
Right. Some of it is quilting. I think with the fabric, but you know,
isn't,
I started thinking
isn't Nevelson
about
just a quilter of wood.
No, I think Nevelson. Well, it started me thinking about Nevelson because, well, let's just talk about Louise Nevelson.
I love quilts, by the way.
I know you do. I know you do. I know you do. You would like my friend's work. It's very nice.
I made
nice.
One quilt years ago, and I said never again because it was too much work.
Yeah, I'm not a big on sewing. I like stitching, but I don't like sewing. But anyway, so Nevelson's work, a lot of it was from, you know, repurposed, found objects.
Not a lot of it. All of it was.
All of it was, yeah. Pretty much.
I guess some of the fabrication, some of the outside sculptures were steel. So that
right,
was
yeah, she did steel. She did some stuff and like pressed papers and everything. Let's talk about her. She was born in Ukraine or Russia. Yeah, 1988. And basically an American sculptor. Known for her massive sculptures.
No, 1899. Was it
1899? 1899. Yeah, she died
in 1988. Yeah, so there's I can't say the word
assemblage.
Now because of some pretentious prick on YouTube was saying, I have it written down here, ensemblage.
Assemblage. Right, it's
assemblage,
kind of.
Assemblage, yeah. What the fuck was that? Have you heard that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Have you heard them?
Yeah.
What the hell is going on with these people?
Okay, assemblage to me is like collage with things, like collage with objects.
It's an assemblage.
The word is assemblage. I know it's assemblage. But
I'm not yelling at you. I'm yelling at the world.
But the every artist that I've seen that has done assemblage refers to it as assemblage.
I've never seen that before. And I went to RISD, goddammit.
I've just hung out here, and that's what they say. But anyway.
Oh, it's so, you backwater hicks that are having a problem.
Backwater hicks, right. We've got to feel important. Anyway, she studied at the Art Students League of New York. And then.
Oh, she studied all over. She studied with Diego and who was the other guy?
Yeah.
Hans or something?
Yeah,
or
Hans Hoffmann.
Hoffmann.
Who they said, they quote him with abstract expressionism, before abstract expressionism, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, they said he precluded. They said he preceded it and influenced it. So anyway, I thought it started in New York, but you know, who am
Did Monk do that? Wasn't Monk the first abstract expressionist?
I think they all get credit for it. I don't know.
I hate Monk, by the way. I think his work is terrible. The Scream.
The scream
is awful.
The Scream
is
just
awful piece.
The first time I saw it, it made me laugh.
If it's meant to terrify you or give you some sense of terror and you laugh at it, I think it's failed.
You know what it reminds me of? And we digress. It reminds me of a really off Van Gogh.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, like if Van Gogh was drunk and half blind and painted backwards.
Right, and he had all the toxicity and the lead or whatever he saw of halos and shit. But, you know, it looks like an off Van Gogh.
I play Halo.
Yeah, it'd be like something, I know you play Halo, but it's like something I would do if I was pretending I was Van Gogh and trying
do you have
to
an
do
Xbox?
Something.
You should play some
I don't.
Halo.
I don't have an
we
Xbox.
Play Halo together.
I don't have an Xbox. Do I have to buy something now?
Years ago. Uh-huh. This is 20 years ago when Halo came out originally. Mm-hmm. I feel so old. These kids, I'm literally playing against kids who were born after Halo came out.
Uh-huh. Oh my
anyway,
God.
I've been playing the whole goddamn time. They've been conceived and grown up and now are holding controllers in their hands.
Oh no.
While I've been playing this game.
Oh, that's funny.
But there was actually a genuine study done that showed that people like ultrasounders, people who were doctors who were sticking things into your body, like endoscopes and endoscopes and other things.
Scopes of other
scopes,
natures. Yeah,
yeah, scopes. So the scope is a camera on the end of a flexible pipe that you stick inside someone. So basically, right, you're kind of guiding this through someone's body, and your vision is detached from, you know, your world. You're actually looking through the camera. So you're kind of in the body, and you're out of your own body.
Uh-huh.
And the studies show that people who played first-person shooters were much better at endoscopy than people who weren't. It, like, increased their success rate by some staggering, like, 30%. So
wow.
I got this game. I got Halo so my wife could play it so she could improve her endoscopy skills. She's a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work out quite as well as I'd hoped because I think she did what I think you would probably do, and she just hid behind the big rock until the aliens were all gone.
I would probably, yeah. I don't know anything about this game, but that sounds like a plan.
Well, you have to kill the aliens. Otherwise, the aliens are going to kill you. Not only were they going to kill you, but they'll destroy the universe, Catherine. So if you don't get out there and kill the aliens, do you want the universe to be destroyed?
It's destroying itself anyway.
Well, then get out. Oh, so you don't care. Okay, well, then sit down behind your rock.
I care. I don't know. I don't know.
Or sit under your rock.
Yeah.
I guess you just have to leave the universe saving to me.
So it didn't help her with her...
No, because she was too afraid to get out behind from the rock.
That's,
I was like,
a scare.
Jennifer, they're not really aliens. Just come out here and help me kill them.
Oh my God, that's so funny. But you know, that kind of makes odd sense. It's like kind of a mastery of an odd skill, and then
right,
you apply it to a real world situation, and you've got awesome endoscopy practitioners.
Or drone strikes. You know, if you want to be a drone operator, it's helpful for that too.
Hmm. Okay then. What were you talking about?
Oh, Nevelson. Nevelson, did she do drone strikes?
No. She just walked around New York and found objects and then assembled them and then spray painted them in monochromatic colors so you'd note the light and shadows. Just, I actually find her boxy work very compelling.
In
I love
way?
It. I just
what,
think
what,
it's,
what
it was
it
was big. Okay, like the first and only Nevelson I've ever seen, obviously, was at the Phoenix Art Museum because I rarely leave Phoenix anymore. And
you've
I've
only seen one Nevelson?
I've seen one Nevelson in person.
Wow.
I know.
I feel such an elite because I've seen, I don't know, three?
Oh, wow. You're just,
well, I grew up
I'm
in
not
New
worthy.
York. They were over New York. And by three, I mean like 300 probably because, mm-hmm, like I said, I grew up in New York, so they're just all over New York.
Right. Right. Yeah, like the Picassos in Chicago. But I just stood in front of it. At first, I thought, what the hell is this shit? And then I stood in front of it. And my friend I was with, and she, you know, who's also, she's a sculptor. She's like, oh, Louise Nevelson. She goes, she was like, you know, I just adored her work. And I think that my gravitation toward recycling things, this is a different friend, not the one that does the fiber. And, you know, she goes, like, that's why I use garbage. I mean, she made mannequins out of literal garbage. I would bring her bags of shred and she put it on the armature, and she still has these creatures she made. It was very interesting. And I'm like, oh, wow. And I just stood in front of her for a long time. And you really do get kind of sucked into the work. It's that piece at the Phoenix Art Museum. Yeah, Royal Tide 5. It was 1960. Painted wood. And it's in that piece is one of her gold pieces. She typically did her monochromatic work in white or black. And she
black
did
it, almost exclusively.
Yeah, almost black. Yeah, and I didn't see very many white. And I think the Tide pieces, everyone that I looked up online, they all seem to be gold. But those are not, they're not very many gold pieces. Most of them are black. And I do prefer the black, to be honest with you. I think they're very captivating. But I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I don't know. I don't know why I said I don't know. I
Did
just
it make
think,
you feel anything?
I just felt sucked in, and I wanted to see what she was using, and I just started thinking in my mind the story. It's like, oh, where'd she find this chair leg or this thing that looks like a foot? And, you know, I just started creating, like just seeing her on the streets of New York with her son, like picking up things and then boxing it up and then boxing it up again in the piece, mm-hmm, and spray painting it. And, you know, my mind kind of, I don't know if I felt anything. I created a little story in my mind and I could almost see her picking things off the street. And it was just very captivating to me. I did look at some more of her work, and I do think she was a sculptor.
Sculptor.
Thank you.
I think one of the problems with being a successful living artist, is that you don't get a chance to edit your work before it goes out,
mm-hmm,
necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you do, maybe you don't. It depends on how fussy you are. And I think Nevelson has, to some degree, suffered from this, because I think some of her pieces are very interesting and engaging, but
right,
there are also a number of pieces that just don't work for me at all. Like, some of them have rhythm. Like, the good ones have a certain type of rhythm
to
them.
They really do. They really do.
But then others just fall completely flat, especially her prints. I mean, her prints are pretty awful. I sent you some links. I don't know if you saw them, and I'll put them on the website. But there's some of her prints are just really awful stuff.
Right. One of the articles I read that I can't cite because I can't read my own writing, but they said that she basically dabbled in painting and printmaking. So that would have been a dabble.
That seems like she's underselling. She studied this stuff, and she some of her early work is lovely. It's a little bit derivative, but it's still nice. Like, it kind of looks like a cross between the drawings that I'm thinking of look like a cross between a Matisse and a Picasso.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're going to be derivative, I think those are probably two good places to be derivative of. They look good on their own, though. So there's that. And then also her early works, her early sculptures, mm-hmm. use simple geometry, like primitive geometry, cubes
yes.
and spheres, and they blend. Oh, so you know what I'm talking
yes,
about. So
yes,
they blend
exactly.
together, and suddenly you realize it's an animal.
Uh-huh.
And those, the forms on those, there's such a delicate sensibility of how those forms are created. Mm-hmm. There's a real mastery of, I think, that sculpture. Mm-hmm. And then she transitions into these, let me know if I'm saying this right, Ensemblage. That's, God damn it.
Well, it's just so pretentious and ridiculous. It's assemblage. I know.
I spent a lot of time on YouTube looking at her work, because on YouTube you can see the video and you can mm-hmm. actually walk around it a little bit rather than, because it doesn't work as well when it's flat. And also when in the video, you get a better sense of the scale. And I think scale has a very big impact on
scale
her work.
Scale is everything, yes.
It's kind of like the Pollock. I get the same vibes off of Nevelson as I do from Pollock, but slightly different. I feel like Pollock is a little bit more engaging,
uh-huh.
but also more limited. When I look at Nevelson, I see her in a gallery, and I mm-hmm. see her 6 foot by 10 foot works, sometimes uh-huh. 3 foot by mm-hmm. 6 foot. She has a lot of different sizes.
Right.
But then I can go outside and I see this amazing sculpture,
mm-hmm.
which is huge and made out of Corten steel. Do you know what Corten steel is?
I have no clue.
It's just a type of steel that's slightly different, formulated a little bit different, so it's designed to rust, but that layer of rust acts as a barrier to further rust. Some steel, like regular steel, will just continue to rust, but Corten rusts once, and then that initial layer of rust protects the work.
Okay, so forms like a protective patina?
Right, so that's a very good way to put it.
Oh, okay.
So, like, any steel you see in Phoenix should be Corten. It's probably not, but it should be. I feel like she's more limited on the two-dimensional scale versus Pollock, but then she's out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
She's all over the place, and she has more dimension that way.
Yes.
Whereas Pollock is almost more intellectual, which is a weird thing to say about Pollock, but he's just two-dimensional, and he's only in the gallery. That's the only place you can really experience him.
That's where you can experience his work.
Yeah, he's like an academic versus mm-hmm. the woman who goes out in the world and just sort of engages the entire world. I feel like the entire world she's pulling into her pieces.
Well, she did have that one quote. She said that she created her world. It was something like she created her world, and it was better than anything she ever saw on the outside.
Well, that's being an artist. I mean, not even an artist. It's being a painter. When I paint worlds.
Right.
But some of her work is terrible. And I think that's one of the problems, is trying to look past that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what I had in my mind when we started talking about her last week. I'm thinking, I remember her on assemblages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember being kind of interested in them, but then not all the way. And I think it's because I have this memory of this duality of some good pieces and some bad pieces.
Her career spans so many years, and as artists evolve and change or dabble into different media or different realms, you know, I think there is a progression to her work. And I don't know.
I think she stays on point. I mean, the early work is clearly very different from what we know of her, but once
right.
she got into the boxes, she stayed on point pretty well. She explored different areas of it, but
yes.
It seems like she really knew what she was doing by that point. Even though, and what I loved about looking at the work again was, I don't think I'd ever seen any of her totems. I mean, I don't know if that's what she referred to them as, but we think of Nevelson as having basically, you look at a wall, and in front of that wall is a bunch of boxes, you know, covering the wall, and it's black. But she also has these tall, narrow pieces, almost
yes.
like a bird in space.
Mm-hmm.
Was that Brancusi who did that one? Yeah, like a Brancusi. They almost look like Brancusi's in a sense, but they read totally differently. And also, I was thinking, she has some very vertical pieces,
mm-hmm.
and some of her pieces are like slices of vertical pieces stuck together.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed those. They had a totally different rhythm for me.
One piece I like, I don't know if you saw it, it's called Seventh Decade Garden, 9 and 10. And they're like two pieces that almost like intertwine. and it's an outdoor piece. It's just beautiful, and that you can see movement, but it's so simple in its design. It's just so simple and so smooth. And I just really like that.
So the point with, I guess, with Nevelson, the end point that I come to is, I think she's making interesting, engaging work.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's a genuine artist.
Oh, absolutely.
But not necessarily a great artist, because I don't feel the emotional engagement. For me, it's more about how she's manipulating the composition. So she's like a master of composition. I get the sense that if you studied that staccato, that rhythm of her work, you could do it yourself. It's not necessarily the kind of thing you could do overnight, but you could. It's almost like a craft. You could develop the skill. And I feel like this is somewhere in between interior design and fine art.
That's an interesting perspective.
Because I love what it does to the environments that they're in. You go into a gallery and you see this, and I find it's very engaging there. Or if it's on the side of a public building.
Right.
There's something engaging about it. The other thing I wanted to say was, she has a lot of her works fit into a pretty rectilinear border.
Mm-hmm.
But not all of them. And I think the ones that don't, the ones that are kind of more broken up and have an irregular border, I found those to be a lot more engaging, a lot more interesting.
Interesting.
That might just probably just reflects something of myself.
It might. And, you know, I don't know that you can do it yourself. I did send you some articles and, I read so much. I was looking up, recycled, art. It's like, how do people use objects in art? Article after article, they just seem very similar. And some of it just did not look like art. It just looked like garbage.
Yeah. Well, that's not uncommon these days.
And no offense, and I won't cite anyone's name or anything, but it just, because I've tried to do this, and I don't know that I could do an assemblage in the style, maybe in the style or as an homage to Nevelson, but it wouldn't resonate.
I think you might be missing my point. It's not the kind of thing you can just do.
Okay.
But I think if you worked at it for a number of years. I don't know how long it would take to get to that level of sophistication.
Right.
But I think it's the kind of thing you could level up into.
Okay.
Because it's basically, in my mind, I see composition. She's working with composition.
Yes.
And I don't know why. I get this sense. She was a very colorful person herself.
Yes.
I mean, she presented herself. She was very careful about how she presented herself.
Yes.
And it feels like it's all wrapped up into one. I mean, she's using New York as her palette in a way.
Yes, I was just going to say that.
Okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, she's
using... you talk about how she's using the palette, New York as her palette.
Well, I think she used New York as a palette with her, her dress, the colors she used, the way she presented herself, and went back to New York from Germany.
I was thinking...
What, go ahead.
Well, she was never in Germany. Oh,
no, she was just
in
Germany briefly when she studied with Hoffman.
Very briefly.
And then she came back and she said it was more of a stepping stone for her career, and the environment provided a lot more.
But New York, as far as, literally she's taking bits and pieces off the street of New York to create these ensembles. So that's her palette. And that brings up an interesting point where you go into, quote, an art store, and it's a bit overwhelming and it takes you out of the process of making art. And this is one of the reasons I always look to different sources, because it's easy to fall into the trap that you go into the art store, you buy a canvas and you buy paint, and then, quote, you're going to make, quote, art.
Right.
And it feels so sterile. And I think one of the reasons maybe that she turned to this is that you get away from that entire vocabulary of what art is. You know, art is paint on a canvas, or it's a bronze statue.
Right.
I have to say, I think I have tried to do the same thing Nevelson does.
Yes.
Several times. I think I've tried on several different occasions. I am drawn to found items, and I'm drawn to try to create now I can't even say the word anymore because I see these stupid pricks dress ensemblage assemblies. I try to make these assemblies of found objects, and I've always failed.
Yes,
every
it's
time
difficult.
I've tried it.
I have too, and I'm always picking stuff up off the street, or I'll find little things. I was in Vegas one time with a friend. I still have this little piece. It looked like a part of a car. You know, the things in the tip of the cars. What are those?
The antenna,
like the old hood ornaments.
Oh, the hood ornament.
Yeah, it looks like an old hood ornament. It's just tiny.
Was it still attached to the car when you found it?
No, it was on the ground in this parking lot at, like, I don't even know where the hell we were, the Monte Carlo or Bellagio. I mean, we just got out of the car and I run up to the, I see this shiny thing and she's like, oh my God. My friend's like, just stop picking shit up off the ground. And I put it, and I have a little box of found objects that I periodically, oh, it's like, not little. I have boxes of boxes and boxes of things, but my boxes of found objects and I don't know what to do with them. And
so
I think
yeah, well, I think I'm in the same boat. We probably will never use it to any valuable. We'll probably never put it to any valuable person, but
no.
Purpose person.
Purpose, right.
And it reminds me of a great artist that I follow on TikTok. I don't know if she's, I guess she's an artist. She's a, she starts with geology. I started following her because she was talking about geological stuff.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out that she does a lot of work around the Great Lakes, and she just has, for her whole life, I don't know, she's probably like 20 or 30, so she's not that old, but...
Mm-hmm.
She walks the Great Lakes and she picks up pieces of plastic that she finds, and she picks up things that aren't supposed to be there. And she has a show, I think it's out in California. I'll link this in the show notes, and maybe we can talk about her next week or the following week or sometime in the future. But she collects these things and she's trying to document what's happening to the Great Lakes. And she puts together these books of these different materials, and she's put them, she separates them by color and by size and whatnot, and basically puts them in little vials and then creates boxes out of them. And it's the kind of thing that I would look at and say, well, that's stupid.
Uh-huh.
But she does it in such a masterful way. She understands the environment and she understands how to build books and put these things together. I'm quite taken with her work.
Oh yeah, link it. I would like to see this.
That's a master. I am not. I just want to cut up graham cracker boxes and make something out of that.
You know what I started saving?
Everything.
Well, other than everything, I bought some Lay's potato chips from my folks, and the bags, I bought one without a lot of salt and then one sour cream and onion.
I don't need to know the...
But the colors mattered because one's green and one's kind of yellow. And I'm like, ooh. And so I'm like, what are these made out of? So I started digging into it a bit, and they're made out of something that's not recyclable. I mean, these are like the most horrible types of plastics that no one can do anything with.
Well, that's the thing. I love that packaging because it's such an amazing material. It's basically aluminum layered or laminated with plastic.
Yes.
So it's, as you say, it's totally unrecyclable. And if you wrap any aluminum into it, you're basically destroying the aluminum. You're binding the aluminum to the plastic, and they cannot be, by current technology, cannot be unbound. But that packaging drives me, I die for it. I love that stuff.
Do you want me to save it for you? Because I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
Oh, no. It's everywhere. I pull off the top to a can of peanuts. It's there.
It's the same thing, right?
Every single candy bar wrapper that you have is made out of this stuff, and it's flexible aluminum. It's amazing. Because the plastic, you get the flexibility from the plastic,
mm-hmm.
and then you get the light blockage and the environmental blockage from the aluminum. It's an amazing, shockingly awesome material.
It is I don't often buy potato chips, and so this was not a new process, but I mean it's not something we eat, and I just was struck with the bag more than the contents.
There are no potato chips in our house.
No,
we
never.
We have more respect for the temples that are our bodies.
Right. Yeah. My heart patient father was craving them, so I thought, what the hell?
No, that's fine. Yeah, you know what? Food is good.
Food is good. So two bags, you know. And I'm like, we're done. But now I'm like, oh my gosh, these are, and I was just really struck with them. And so I kept them and I thought, what can I do with this? And I don't know. I'm just going to keep them.
I think you can cut them up and reassemble them.
I'm thinking of doing that. Yes.
And you can do it in 2D or 3D because, you know, they don't stretch. That's the other thing about it. I mean, they're flexible, but they don't stretch.
It's very cool. Yeah, it's very cool. I thought of using that on, I had found some, speaking of found objects again, when we had all those storms several weeks ago or a month ago or whatever, when the monsoon actually came in and rained. And there's a lot of palm trees in this neighborhood. And so I found all these palm pieces, and several of them looked like torsos. The way it looks like a torso
to
me. Yeah, it does.
Sicko.
Well, I held it up for Misha, and she said it looked like a torso also. And so I saved like three or four of them, and I dried them off, and then I cleaned them. And I don't know. I don't want to really gesso them. I'm trying to figure out how to use them.
Well, As long as you haven't bathed with them, I think we're okay.
Yeah, no. I just, you know, I was like, oh, are there bugs on it? You know, it's from the outside. I'm not big fond of like bugs and stuff. So I let them dry out and I had them on the floor of the studio and they look pretty cool. And I'm just trying to think of something ethereal or something to do, but I might use those potato chip bags. I'll probably have to buy more potato chips to get more stuff. And I
just
could
go
cut them.
The trash.
No, oh no, uh-uh.
You don't dumpster dive?
Oh, no. Are you kidding me?
Wow. That's very disappointing to
no,
hear.
No, the only
you
thing
need
I would
do. You get
dirty
for your art.
No, what I would do is like, you know, when they do bulk trash pickup,
mm-hmm.
if I see something that's like just kind of standing there alone or, you know, there's something interesting.
Yeah, that's good time. I love
yeah,
bulk trash.
Yeah, I would do a bulk trash. I won't dumpster dive. No. No, just the thought of like germs. Mm-mm.
Oh, relax.
Mm-mm. No, I don't relax. Are you kidding me? My blood pressure is like.
So I'm going to just rewind for a minute and get back to Nevelson. I have only one more thought on the topic.
And go ahead.
That was, so I compared it to Pollock.
Right.
And the only other artist I was thinking about comparing her to was Rothko, because I think of Rothko as kind of in the same boat as far as between interior design and art.
Right.
Is I've never really felt much from a Rothko. I appreciate mm-hmm. them. I like them. And if you're standing in front of one, mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to look at a Rothko on the internet or in a book. You have mm-hmm. to kind of have the size. And this is the same thing with Nevelson. The size really matters.
Agree. The size matters.
Both of them are dealing with composition and kind of how you are in that space
mm-hmm.
and how you're interacting with a piece. That's it. Just that, you know, I think of Rothko and her as being kind of on the same level. Not quite fine art.
Mm-hmm.
Artists, but not great artists.
People recognize her as one of the preeminent sculptors of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, I don't. So
okay,
you know,
so that's
that
all
count.
That matters. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And yeah, and I know a lot of her work. She got a lot of commissions in the 70s. And I think that was attributed probably to the women's movement that was happening at the time.
That seems like you're kind of taking away from her. Power
no,
as a sculptor,
I think. Read that, and I think, but
that's
fine.
Well, here's the problem. You know, one of the big problems I came across when I was doing some research on her is that, boy, when you have non-objective work like this,
uh-huh.
it's so easy, and people just love to make up their own stories about mm-hmm. it and present it like, oh, this is the academic take on this nonsense,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or not the nonsense, but the take is the nonsense.
Right. Well, I felt that it denigrated her work. They're like, oh, you know, it's almost like she only became well known and commissionable because of the political cycle that was currently going on when she had been doing work since the 40s and 50s, you know,
since
and a lot
20s.
Of in the 20s. Right. Well, yeah. Well, right.
I guess that's possible, but I saw the work as standing on its own, especially for public commissions. I would commission
yes.
the hell out of her if I could.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
I don't know why. I mean, I like I said, I see the compositional value of it. I see the rhythm. I see that it's a developed language that she has here.
Yes.
But even so, I guess that's enough for me.
Yeah, that's enough. That's enough. Is there anything else?
No, I mean, it's enough for me that, you know, that she has that compositional delicacy, that
right.
ability to create composition out of pretty simple forms. I guess the only other thing to say is it's interesting once you see the full body of her work,
mm-hmm.
it's easier to see her roots from cubism. And clearly
yes, I
she's
think
got cubism on the brain.
That's what I was going to say. Do you see that same with Rothko, though?
No.
Okay.
I haven't researched him, though, as much.
Okay.
So I'm just
thinking
because
I saw cubism. And Diego Rivera was really heavy into cubism. That was part of the, you know, his journey. And I know she
right.
helped him on that one mural.
And isn't that interesting? Well, it's interesting because I see his forms and her forms being similar, and I see them both talking back to like pre-Columbian art.
Yes.
Where these simplified, but not simple, simplified forms that are repeated over and over again. And I see that in Diego's work, and I see that in her work as well. It's just interesting to see these threads.
Right. Well, they all studied, you know, it was like they were artists. They were, you know, at the same time. And they came out of similar. I mean, that's what was going on. That was the environment. And so maybe that also affects.
Maybe that's why they are important, because they were able to represent part of their time. And we see that.
Right. I think it really marks that time. And I do see the cubist influence like throughout.
You know, one question I didn't think about it. I don't, I looked at the work pretty much on its own feet, on its own merits.
Mm-hmm.
Not feet, merits. I don't
right.
know why I said feet. I don't know if there's any gender to it. I mean, does it matter that she was a woman? I didn't think about that at all when I was looking at the work.
No, I don't see. But most art, other than maybe Kahlo's, I don't see a gender bias. Do you?
Cassatt was kind of, there's a little bit more obviousness with Cassatt.
Right. But when you're just looking at like abstract figurative, other than some of the Fauvist.
What was his name? Motherall?
Motherwell?
No.
Motherwell?
I'm thinking of someone else whose name I can't remember now, but okay. He like made mostly a non-objective painter, but he did some abstract as well. He had these monstrous women.
Oh.
I can't remember his name.
Oh, I know who you're talking. It was like he did the stuff in Tahiti?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, he's an American artist. And okay. I can't imagine a woman painting like that.
Okay.
And I mean that in a nice way.
Right.
Anyway, I think we're just kind of, at least I'm just blabbering on now.
Yeah, we're babbling because we're just art critics in our own mind. We're just legends in our own mind. Legends in our own mind.
On this podcast.
And people have listened to this podcast, and that, I don't know if I find that interesting or frightening, but thank you.
Thank you. Share with your friends or your enemies.
Your enemies.
More importantly, your enemies. I have one final task that I would like you to perform for me, Catherine.
Me?
Yes.
Okay, what?
I would like you to properly pronounce assemblage for me one more time.
Assemblage.
No. The way the art snobs say.
Oh, assemblage.
Assemblage.
Yeah, think of collage. Think of collage.
I will think of nothing.
And then assemblage. I do a lot of collage.
No, I didn't want you to talk about collage. I just wanted to say the word.
Well, it's collage with objects.
Don't go beyond your mandate. You're going beyond outside your mandate now.
Hey, we don't dig mandates in Arizona.
And we're 45 minutes. You think people can put up with this for 45 minutes?
I don't. Anyone who does will make an assemblage in your honor.
Oh, God.
Okay, enough.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you, James.
Bye.
Bye.